Following podcast is an exclusive presentation of Project Entertainment Network.
In a world where podcasts lurk around every corner.
Listen, we just have to give the people what they want. Get it together.
Authors Tim Meyer and Chad Scanlon invite you to an hour of sophisticated conversation.
I just want to rip your head off for even saying that.
Dude, I'm just saying what you're thinking.
From movies and TV to special guests, you name it, they've got it.
I'd rather gouge my eyes out than watch that movie ever again.
That's one of the finest movies of our generation.
How are you both married?
Join them every Wednesday exclusively from the Project Entertainment Network.
Hey everybody, welcome to Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. We're going to jump up into 1966 today and talk about I call it sort of a quirky little movie, but I liked it. And it sets off a string of four movies that are all tied together. Can't do this by myself, though, so I had to go out and hogtie Mark Maddox once again to talk about the Wild, Wild Planet. Come on in, Mark. Let's talk about this wild, wild movie. take the gag off. Yeah, that's right. Get the gag.
So, wait a minute. Now, you said that Wild, Wild Planet starts off a list of me. That wasn't the first film, was it?
I think it was the first one, wasn't it? I thought it was the first of the four.
I thought it was the last one. Or they did them so fast.
They were all done. Yeah, I was going to say all four of them were done within 4 years of each other.
We'll check.
We'll double check on that. Yeah. Oh, and speaking of double checking, I want to pay credit to one of my regular listeners. The guy's been a really good supporter of Monster Attack, and he caught me. He caught me in a mistake on last week's show, and I've done it before, apparently. When I was talking about The Incredible Shrinking Man, I want to get this just out front. I want to be totally transparent here. And I mentioned the film then, and I attributed them to Jack Arnold, and that's not a Jack Arnold film. I've done that before. I do that all the time. And so, and he was afraid. He says, I don't want to be that guy. And I said, no, you got to tell me. Keep me honest. No, that was Gordon Douglas. So anyway, buddy, I'm not going to mention a name. I'm not going to embarrass you. But thank you for pointing that out, because I think that's like two or three times I have said that them was a Jack Arnold film. So he held it in until three times the mark and says, I got to tell you.
So, yeah, I mean,
I stand corrected.
Yeah, you screwed up.
I did.
Jack Arnold movies. Part of the thing is that a lot of his stuff deals with either miniaturization or gigantic animals and stuff too. And them was, I'm pretty sure them was the first giant creature movie.
1954.
Definitely was the best acted and written one, but then Arnold made Tarantula and some other ones.
I think that's where I get confused. I think that's why I would confuse myself, because Jack Arnold clearly was Tarantula. And so what? Spider? Ants. Why not? You know, but anyway, I wanted to make sure people understood.
So it's all cleared.
Oh, yeah. I screwed up.
Yeah. You're dumb.
I'm dumb.
So anyway.
If you guys ever catch me in that, be sure to drop me a note, because I will acknowledge it. I'm not like some people in Washington that I know that never make a mistake. So I do make mistakes from time to time.
I do know that we do make mistakes on the show. Okay,
I'm never going to
sit here and act like I'm some authoritarian. I've had people that have written me later and said things about things that I've said. I've had a few times I've been, had people correct me, but a lot of people will even appreciate that I say up front, our information is not always 100% accurate. We're dealing in a pretty good ballpark figure, but it happens, I leave that kind of stuff to the experts. What we talk about on the show is for the fun of the movies. you know, some basic information, trying to get as much of it as we can right, and enjoy talking about films that a lot of people just aren't talking about.
We've
brought out some that people just, I don't even know if some of the films we've done have ever seen the seen the light of day on a podcast. So
that's true.
You know,
that's true.
We're just talking
now, by the way,
trying to get people
that are listening to this saying, how did they get off on this tangent? I've got the answer to your question, where this all started. And that is the very first film in the series of four science fiction films dealing with Gamma One is The Wild, Wild Planet.
Oh my God.
Jim, I was actually right on that
right.
one.
Wow. That's so good. I heard Edgar Winters writing an opera about you being right for once. Yeah, okay.
That's right.
Cool. Right after the Journey to the Center of the Earth album he's doing. No, I mean, I don't know why. You know why I thought probably that was the last one? Because to me, it's just about the best one. I mean, and I figured maybe the
it is. Went it on. Actually is, yeah.
We picked on one of their films. I don't remember
the name. War of the Planets. We did, or I'm
War
sorry,
of the Planets.
I think it was Battle of the Planets, actually. Now, here I go. I'm going to make another mistake. But
No, I think it was no War.
I think it was War, too. I do, too.
And
it's quite
and
a while
War
back.
War of the Planets or Battle Next Door to the Planets or one of those films. And we kind of picked on that one a little bit.
Bit.
We weren't ecstatic about it. I remember we still gave it a better thumbs up than The Creeping Terror, but we weren't too kind to it. This one.
Oh, I was kind to the female co-star. I mean, I liked her.
You were always kind to the female co-star.
We did a podcast in season one on War of the Planets, which is number two in the series. Battle of the Planets is three, and Snow Devils is number four. So there we go. I'm just going to ignore that joke.
You got it, right?
No. I got it. Yes. It stunk.
You'll be driving down the road tonight or something like that and just bust out laughing. That was funny.
Yep, that's true, yeah. Like that scatological humor. That's right. So anyway, so this is a series of four films.
Yes, and today's is Wild, Wild Planet, which is the first one. Now, what I was told, once again, here comes the vague information.
Yeah.
I can't remember if it was my buddy Rodney Barnett or somebody told me that these were originally shot to go right on to television.
He is absolutely right, though that is true. I did research on that one.
Unless that was you that told me that. But
television. No. When you told me that, I wanted to double check it, and I double checked it. And that is absolutely true.
Yeah.
They were made for TV films originally, and then they got looking at them, and they said, hey, let's put them in the theater. And so they did it in sort of limited release, and they found a following.
And I'll say the one we're talking about today deserves, in its own, fun, fast-paced, cheesy way, deserves to go to a movie theater. I'm glad I saw it at the movie theater.
Yeah.
I'm glad it wasn't just a television movie.
That's right.
But I saw this film years ago in its initial release. I think I saw it in 67 at the air base in Ramstein, Germany as a little kid. And I never remembered the name of the movie. And for years, I went around. I remember this movie where I believe the guys were like swimming in an ocean of blood and there was weird stuff going on. And I remember the scene with the people in front of the ocean of blood there with two people on lab tables and stuff, and thinking, boy, this is really creepy and weird.
It was.
But like a lot of us pre-internet and even still to this day, we all have films that we remember images from. We could not remember the name of the film.
That's true.
And luckily, about I think about 7-8 years ago, something happened, and I found out the information I had been looking for decades, and watched it on YouTube originally, and now it's available, I think, on Warner Archive.
Yes, it is.
And purchased it, and it's a fun, cheesy, fun movie. It's got a lot of things going for it. Go ahead.
I was going to say, and it's always fun when you have that kind of experience. I hope that people that listen to the podcast have a chance to have that experience, because I think sometimes we talk about films that someone might be listening to and go, that's that movie. That's the one I was trying to think of, because I just recently experienced it with another one that I'm going to talk about one of these days on the podcast called The 27th Day, that makes a lot of lists of films that people should have seen from the 50s and 60s sci-fi. And all I remembered was two or three scenes from it. And the other day I came across a streaming copy of it and watched it. And it was one of those moments where I went, oh, my God, that's that movie. movie, you know, because I couldn't think of the name of it for the longest time. So it's always fun. Hopefully, maybe somebody out there is going, Wild Wild Planet. Yeah, that's the one. Okay. Now, there's rumor out, and again, this is one of those vague pieces of information. I think I've made one reference to it when I did the show on the Green Slime. It's always been rumored that Green Slime was like the unofficial fifth film in this series.
Yeah.
And I think we've both talked about that because it deals with Gamma One. And, of course, they destroy Gamma One in that film. I know, spoiler alert, but you would have gotten that on the podcast, folks, so it doesn't matter. So it almost acted like it might have been the fifth one because the effects are the same. It's not an Antonio Margheriti film, but but it has all of the looks.
Yeah, even though it's got a large Japanese influence on it, directed and I think filmed and directed in Japan.
Yes, it was.
Green
it was
Slime,
shot.
Which we love. Yeah. We love Green Slime. Slime, is a great fun movie. But today's movie is no slacker either. And I remember when I saw it again, all I could think about was the Green Slime. And then later, that's when Tim Lucas told me that there was kind of an unofficial thing about it being another one in the series, to speak. It definitely had the Gamma One space station thing going on with it. So anyway, but
you're right. This
ready
is
to start talking about it.
This then. Is a totally fun film, and it moves. And I mean, we come right out of the blocks with our lead guy, Commander Mike Halstead, who appears. He'll appear in the third film in the series. He'll be in the battle for the planets, and not he wasn't in War of the Planets. That was a whole different bunch. But you've got some continuing people there. Mike Halstead's an interesting guy. The actor who plays him, Tony Russell, I think he may be I think he may have been the only American actor in this movie. I could stand corrected on that. I think it was virtually an Italian cast with this one exception. And a little bit, you know me, I always like to go digging for some trivia on some of these guys. Sure. Tony Russell's an interesting guy. I mean, when you look at him in this movie, it's like, I've seen that guy somewhere before. And, you know, but he had a big career in Italy because it wasn't going too well for him here in the United States. So he went to Europe and did really well. But the one thing I did not know about him was that when he was in Italy and after he did this film and a couple of others, he got discovered, he was offered a role in a Sergio Leone film called Fistful of Dollars. He was offered the lead and he turned it down because he said, an Italian Western? You got to be crazy. It's not going to do anything.
Wow.
And guess what? Clint Eastwood gets the role and the rest is history. Just so close.
Well, sometimes people make those mistakes.
It's true.
You know?
But he's definitely got the acting. He's got the acting chops and the screen presence to really lead this film. I think he's an excellent choice for the lead in the film.
Well, it is interesting, too, I was surprised again when I watched it the other day. That the guy who played Django, the same year as
Franco
Django
Nero
is in it.
Franco Nero. Yeah.
And I was like, wait a minute, because for some reason I had forgotten, even though I've seen it about two or three times in the last like 7 years. I was still kind of taken aback by it. And then I looked at the date and it's got a 66 date. And I think Django's, if it isn't 66, it's close to it.
It was right around the same time that he made that
same
film.
Time,
and, but, you know, of course, with Franco Nero, he did so much work in the United States that at first when I saw this, I thought, yeah, okay, there's a couple of Americans in this movie. He's from Italy. He is an Italian actor. Probably he is the most successful American performer out of this whole cast. You know, he went on to, Mike, he's still acting. I mean, he's still got stuff going on.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, still going and, a massive body of work. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much we're going to go on the plot. The plot's so crazy. It's,
I love it, though.
Because
I mean, basically, and again, a lot of spoilers here, folks. So if you're here not wanting to have the plot line spoiled, you may not want to listen to us much here.
Yeah, watch
because the way I jump around
real quick.
And so,
go watch because, it real quick and then
yeah,
come back.
Yeah, because some of the, yeah. some of the, you know, because I do like to talk about the things that, that stuck out to me, and Mark does too, you know, and some of the influences on this. When I first started watching this film the first time, it was way, way back. And then when Mark told me about it again, I was able to find it. And I think when I saw it last year, it might have been the first time I'd seen it probably in almost 35, 40 years. I kept thinking it was going to be like a sci-fi alien type thing. You know, doesn't it come off that way, that something yeah. weird is going on, because you've got this weird guy dressed up in black with black sunglasses and a black hat walking around mysteriously, and he's killing people. You've got this strange doctor played by Massimo Serrato. He's a face that's very familiar, and I couldn't figure out why I knew this guy. I didn't really know him. He looks sort of like Errol Flynn. Or, you know, one of those type, he had a little mustache, you know, that pretty boy type who plays this scientist right. by the name of Mr. Nurmi. And it's like, yeah, this guy's got to be an alien. You know, they're trying to invade Earth or something here, or invade this Gamma One. And it's not that at all. I mean, you find out about halfway through the film, there's no aliens really, not really involved in this whatsoever. And that's one of just many hooks that you're going to find in this movie. So it's got the man in black who is a clone, and all this other crazy stuff, people getting kidnapped, people getting shrunk. I tell you what, this last time around, I watched it just a couple of days ago, and I wanted to look at maybe the influence this movie it had on other films, you know, from that were made by guys our age, you know, directors our age. And I can see films like Phantasm and others like that that I think were really influenced by this film from some yeah. of the different crazy things they did in there.
Yeah. The thing with the movie is, I think it was touted as like the first horror science fiction movie, which really yeah. kind of doesn't make a lot of sense because technically a lot of science fiction movies before this were also horror films. I mean, Tarantula, Them is still kind of technically a horror film.
Yeah.
But the weirdness is that, and I'm not going to run the plot in a straight line. It's you've got this guy, you've got a lot of like living or body parts
yes.
on platters under glass domes on these in this future world. It's in the future. It takes place in the future.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you've got these little cars with fins, and sometimes I don't even think they're cars. I think they're pushing bicycle pedals, and
I'm not sure what they are. Yeah,
the road. Yeah, but it's in the future, and there's this weird thing going on with this scientist who's creating body parts and all this stuff, and he's also got these weird sort of clones that are grabbing specific people, and he's the thing about this, what Jim was talking about, the guy with the glasses, he's got a bald head and a little cap, and he's got
right.
this terrible looking shower curtain cape that he walks around with, but when he attacks. You see him start to attack in his arms, and you finally find out he's got four arms under that cape.
Yeah.
So he attacks, grabs a person, and somehow in hugging them or whatever the hell it is he's doing, he miniaturizes them, shrinks them down. We even have one god-awful scene where a guy is like shrunk only part of the way, and,
right.
and so for the rest of the film he's played by a little person.
Yeah.
And it's like it's so off the chain. It's so bizarre, and you've got this kick squad of karate killer women. It's almost like a precursor to Joanna Cassidy in Blade Runner.
That's
you
true.
Know?
That's true.
And they're going around. They're capturing these people, and then they're being taken back into space for this new utopia this guy's wanting to build. That's basically the big spoiler of the film, the big ending. But you've got these
right.
bunch of handsome, brick-headed looking good guys that are going around trying to figure things out. And of course, the main Brian Brickhead, the head guy, our hero, is sort of like in love with one of the girls that now the evil scientist is in love with or wants to be with her. And it turns out at the end of the film, here comes a big spoiler. He wants to – the evil scientist wants to take this woman that he figures is basically perfect, and he wants to – and I don't even know how they're actually going to do it because we never get that far. It is a moment where they are going to merge together and
yes.
become one person.
I get – well, like, I mean, okay. you know, yeah, he's sort of cloning a perfect race from these people that he selected.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, that's the best way I can describe it. And, yeah, they give you this hint that he is – this new creature or being that they're going to create is half him and half her. You know, so I guess some kind of gene splicing or something of that nature. Who
yeah.
knows? Because this is before –
replicate or is it going to be
– yeah,
what
yeah.
is it going to be? That's when I saw it again the other day. I'm like, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's way ahead of its time. I mean, this is way ahead of when we were actually into that kind of thing. You know, this 66.
What's this person going to look like? What's this person going to look like without their clothes on? You know?
Yeah, that. I got to admit, I thought this. I thought the same thing. Yeah, it's like, this could get very bizarre. Let's not go out on a.
Yeah.
Are you going to go out on a date with this person? That's the question I always ask. It's like, no.
Right. It's like, yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, you're watching this take place. Now, here's one of the things that I thought as a child that, and I brought it up earlier, and now I think, I'm not sure if I'm vindicated or not. It still isn't quite clear. The thing that freaked me out the most as a kid was the fact that on the planet's surface where they finally end up, there is an ocean of red around a lot of the ceremonial areas. And in another scene in the film, we see the villain disposing of unwanted body parts and stuff.
Yeah.
He's got all these ugly mutants and stuff that were his failures.
Yeah.
But he still throws the body parts away, but he keeps the mutants to remind himself his screw-ups. In a room where it's sort of like, if you're killing everybody, why are you leaving your, you know, these bizarre, you know, guy with a hand growing out of his shoulder and all this other kind of stuff? Why are you keeping them alive? I think it was just
if you're thinking of the movie Brain That Wouldn't Die, that's where he got the idea, I think. Yeah, he said, well, if that scientist did it, I've got to do it. Yeah, because that's one of the films I'm thinking might have been influenced by this one, or vice versa. All the mistakes in the closet there.
yeah, really. But the thing is that when he's getting rid of scraps of tissue and stuff that he doesn't use anymore, they show him throw it into this giant, what looks like a fish tank.
Yeah.
But what I am led to believe is that there is so much of it, and it's almost like a biological planet. I might be completely wrong, but that tank is also connected to that part, that lake or ocean or whatever the hell it is, that basically comes out looking like some sort of what's the word I'm looking for? Then blood, it would be blood, but what would you call blood if it was like the oceans there? Sort of like it reminds me of the Vampirella comics that the rivers there flowed blood on her planet. And that was kind of the what I was led to believe, and like I said, I might be wrong. But the material and everything, it's like a biological liquid, for lack of a better
term. I think you're right. Yeah, well, and it definitely, the suggestion near the end of the movie was that it had a detrimental effect on humans, because the people that fell into the water, it screwed them up. I mean, it hurt them. Like an acid
effect
almost.
But the heroes grab breathing devices and swim across it real quick, and that's
so they're
really
okay
the
with
shocking
it.
Image I took from as a kid, I was probably six when I saw it, and so when I was watching again the other day, I kind of paid a little more attention to that aspect of it. And I think, yeah, I mean, it seems like they're saying it's all one giant vat, one giant lake, one giant ocean of this planet. And, you know, I don't think the guy had so many bad experiments and so many scraps that he threw them into a tank and they formed an ocean. So anyway, enough of my issues with the clarity of the film. There's neat cars. There's a scene with they're shrinking people down and actually, kind of hijacking them to this other planet, and they're small enough. They get shrunk down to about the size of G.I. Joe dolls. The 12
G.I.
Joe
right.
dolls, not the little one.
Right.
And then they regrow them again when they get them back to the planet.
Yeah.
They're smuggling people out, and I'm assuming they're smuggling scientists. There's one scientist who's they screw him up when they go to shrink him. They only get part of the way down, and oddly enough, the reason that they do it is because the man's granddaughter is screaming grandpa, and they turn and they kill her. They kill this little kid. This woman strangles her to death.
That's a scene that stayed with me for a long time because
it was a little bit of a surprise.
As we've talked about many monster movies, it was sort of an unwritten rule in monster movies and still in horror films nowadays, although they've relaxed it a bit. You don't show a kid getting killed in a monster movie. You just don't.
Yeah.
You can imply it. You can talk about it. I mentioned this on Curse of Frankenstein, where the creature played by Christopher Lee kills a little boy, but you never see it. You just know he did it because of the bag that the little kid was carrying was scattered all over the for us. But
right.
You see it here. I mean, you actually physically see the act committed. And I got to think, for 1966, I'm surprised it made it through the censors on that one, you know, on the rating system. I'll tell you why it didn't, because this is pre-rating. They hadn't really officially begun rating films in the United States when this was one of the last ones to be released before the, because I think the ratings went into effect in 67 or 68. So that may have been the only way they got away with it. I didn't see this on TV, so I don't know if it made it on the TV version or not. It would be interesting if anyone out there had seen it.
Television.
I didn't either.
Because they
saw it in the movie theater, like you.
Their initial point was that it was supposed to go straight to TV.
Yeah.
And here it is now. We're talking about it, and neither one of us ever saw it on television. We saw it at the movie theater.
Yep.
So go figure.
Yeah, you know, it was released at the end of summer of 1967 here in the United States. You probably saw it a little before I did, because if you saw it in Germany, in the United States it came out like in August of 67 or something. I saw it at the end of the summer vacation, and
Or it could have been the same time.
It could have been close. But I never saw it. I don't think it ever made the Monster Movie Matinee circuit or any of that. It was on my, on the little Saturday afternoon monster sci-fi run that came through the town every week.
Yeah. It was just one of those weird things. There was that movie, and then there was another one. What the hell was the name of that real bizarre one? I think Jim Danforth actually loaned some of his miniatures to it or whatever. But I got to see some oddball films at the base as a kid. Now, I don't put stuff in there like Fantastic Voyage and Quatermass and the Pit, but I'm talking about lower budget, quirky films. You still got a love for them, but definitely not top rung science fiction either.
True.
But there's a lot of things, but there's a lot of in this film, there's a lot of pretty girls. There's a lot of fisticuffs.
Yes.
There's a lot of, the action stuff is like, hey, we got to stop those guys kind of attitude amongst the heroes.
Right.
Some really bad miniatures. at the beginning, there's this one helicopter that looks like it's the toy helicopter that looks like it cannot get off the helicopter pad.
Yeah.
And every time they switch back to a shot of the city, that same helicopter is still trying to lift off. It's absolutely hilarious.
I think the one thing that really dates this film, special, and like you said, it's definitely, you're talking about a futuristic film because they got this big space station, with their wild little cars and stuff, was the telephones. Yeah. And I think anybody that grew up during our time period and see the telephones that they have of this movie, well, I had friends that owned that kind of phone. We didn't. It was pretty expensive back then, where the dial is on the bottom of the phone that you set on the table, and it's like a big, looks like a big hook type thing. You speak into the bottom and listen to the top. But back then, that was cool as anything. That was a very futuristic
those were gorgeous
thing.
Like, you'd see those on spy shows and stuff too. They were gorgeous looking telephones. That's one thing I actually kind of miss, an older technology that I miss is, phone design. I mean,
that's
at stuff even from the 70s, the 60s, the 50s, all these different kinds of phone styles that they came up with. I mean, like you think of like the phones that are on the Prisoner television series.
Right.
And things like that. They're just so neat. And now we all basically have our phones are a little flat, very thin looking flat.
Well, they look like, communicators or something from Star Trek, pretty much.
They don't even have that. You don't even.
Well, no, that's right. Those are the old flip phones. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah, we've actually gone beyond that. But
gone beyond that.
The let me try to think of what other things I can say positive about this film. Okay, it's in color.
That was a real plus. No, it really was. We didn't have a color TV in my house until 1969. So all of these monster movies I talk about here, for the most part, Monster Attack, I saw them black and white. Because I had a black and white TV set. So, anytime you could see something in color, that was, worth the price of admission right there.
Yeah, they, even though color television was already prevalent in the U.S., base television for us was black and white. I think it stayed black and white there into the 70s. But you could go to the movie theater and see something in color, and this definitely was that. They had a lot of close-ups of like human organs that were still supposedly alive.
Right.
Some of it I wonder how they made it. I wonder if they were like something from cattle or something, which
I know
is its own form of makes you kind of squeamish when you think about that.
Pretty much
potentially true, but you watch this movie and you do get a sense through the whole film that it's dark. It's a fairly, and I don't mean just that the lights are turned down. I mean, it's a fairly dark.
No, it's an intense film.
Ridiculous. Yeah. It is. It's wild. You know, the word Wild Wild Planet isn't that far off. But it's got a dark, what's the word I'm looking for?
I think you're looking for a dark undertone to the story.
A dark undertone to the whole film. Even despite as corny and as silly as the overall pacing and plot and everything is, it still leaves you with a little bit of an icky feeling, which I'm not saying that's bad, but I definitely would recommend it to the people. I would definitely say if you doing Monster Attack, we've talked about a lot of cheesy movies. Some of them we've actually not liked. I would say this is one that's in a cheese range, but is still got some fun merit to it.
And it moves, it never gets boring. I can't think of a slow time in this movie. It's an hour and 33 minutes. So, for back then, that's a pretty good clip for a movie. If it had made it to TV, it'd been a 2-hour film. It never gets slow. I mean, it's just flying through and they constantly throw different things at you. The twists and the turns of this film is what surprised me because you get so used to these films from the early 60s and late 50s that the storyline's pretty simplistic. This one is not. It is very complex, and just when you think they're going to wrap up the story or whatever, boom, something new pops up. And especially when they get to the big climax at the end with the planet there, with the big lake of blood and stuff. I mean, there's a lot still yet to come. I mean, it really. Yeah. And then I guess you could call it. It sort of ends on a little bit of a happy ending. I mean, it has a nice little epilogue to it. But like you said, there's still that spooky, creepy feeling like, something very, very bad just happened here. I mean, you still have that taste, that it's okay. The main people survived, but not without some major costs. It was very unusual for a movie back then.
Yeah. I mean, people nowadays were used to movies like Aliens and stuff like that. And Alien where the whole point is we've got a very advanced team of movie technicians giving you stuff that really is haunting.
Right.
You've got to run this through a 1960s filter.
You do.
This is pre the big budget Exorcist Alien kind of thing. But if you're able to do it, you'll probably have a pretty good time. I know I did.
Yeah.
I've seen it. Like I said, I've seen it 3 times. Usually when a movie, even if it is something I finally got to see after years of not seeing, if it's not that good, I have a tendency to sort of it's up on the shelf for a decade or two before I watch it again.
Right.
And in this case, I've watched it. You and I talked about it and wanted to do it as a show. So,
And, we were speaking about the writer in this film. I'm going to add one more on one of the crew people in this film. Of course, we talked about Antonio Margheriti, who's classic cult, horror, sci-fi Italian director who was made reference to in the movie Inglourious Basterds because he was a favorite of Quentin Tarantino's, so he wanted to make sure he worked him into the film. But the writer is a guy by the name of Ivan Reiner, who's American. He was an American writer, so he's one of the other one of the few Americans that participated in this film. And Ivan not only wrote the screenplay for Wild Wild Planet, but he also wrote the screenplay for all of the other three as well as the Green Slime. So that may be another reason why the Green Slime has been sort of connected in with the other four, because it's definitely a distinct style, and I got to tell you, I'm going to give him kudos because I thought the story was pretty solid on this one. It was very it was dense, it was deep, well thought out. It wasn't your typical action sci-fi 60s type storyline. It actually nibbled around some pretty heavy subjects. I think that's why you get that impression that you've just seen a very intense film for its time.
Well,
but you got to put the filters on.
You're telling me something that I did not know about the writer, and definitely if it's the same guy that wrote the Gamma thing, then you've definitely tied it together 100%.
It is, yep.
It's still the Gamma. It's one of his stories, and whether he was floating it around or what, in the end, it ended up being that that this is all part of this from the same mind of the same guy.
From the mind of this guy,
To call it a direct series without the companies doing it or whatever, that would be one thing. But definitely the Gamma plot line is this man's work. So that's cool. I didn't know that. That's definitely a surprise.
I didn't either until we were getting ready to do the podcast, and I doing a little homework on it. Ivan also was an associate producer on all four of those films and Green Slime. So there are definitely some big tie-ins there. I always wondered, maybe someone out there knows the answer to this question if you're familiar with the career of Antonio Margheriti. I love saying that. Why he occasionally took on the alias of Anthony Dawson, which he does in this film. I never could figure out. It's like, why not let people know who you are? I don't see what the big deal was.
Well, are you talking about the director changing his name? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, well, I mean, in this he's credited in this film when you look at the credit line, it says directed by Anthony Dawson. But when you look at and into the credit line, it says produced by Antonio Margheriti.
Tell you why. It's prejudice.
Okay. Yeah, tell me why.
I hate to be. It's prejudice. Yeah, I think you can get away now that the movie's over. You can tell them who actually made it. But at the beginning, it's like, well, we need Jim Smith as the hero and Tony Reynolds, Tony Reynolds, Tony Simpson as his buddy and all this kind of stuff.
Right.
And they changed their names because they figured people would go, what's all this, what's all these Italians?
What's
doing
all this
here?
Italian stuff?
That's just
okay.
The bottom line.
Yeah.
Jack Kirby changing his name from Jack Kurtzenberg. I mean, Stan
true.
Lee changing
well, that's
his
true.
Name.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a bit of a prejudice, which is sad to say, but people are smarter now and they go back and they unearth these things. So, given the people their right names to the best of our ability. We like the fact that there was a diverse thing going on in the world and it just all our science fiction and horror wasn't
absolutely.
Just coming from the United States. That would be boring. Hell, besides, we'd run out of stuff real fast.
You got that
to
right.
talk about. When I was
right.
a kid, it was very limited to understanding what you only saw so much because a lot of these packages didn't get seen.
You've got
your pals now that are film experts that go in and they know all the histories of guys from Italy and Spain and Germany and France and there's so much more such a bigger place to sample from the smorgasbord. It isn't just Universal Monsters and Hammer films and stuff. You've got more to work with. You've got
there's
more to take in. Fun.
Yeah.
Fun, So
folks, I think we're both in agreement to recommend folks, if you have not seen The Wild Wild Planet, it's very easy to find. It will not be hard for you to find. You got to check it out. I would say for those who might still be a little skeptical, in the same way that when I first saw an Italian spaghetti western and fell in love with that whole genre, you may feel the same way about these Italian sci-fis from the 60s. There is just something very engaging about them. It really is.
Yeah.
And you'll probably want to check out some of the others, even the one we did, which we weren't really kind to, but I mean we were okay.
Yeah.
But,
we did it. We did it on purpose, though. We put that one first.
Yeah, that's
we
right.
We put that one first because we wanted to start on a low and work our way up.
And
I
work
think.
Our
I
way
mean,
up.
Truly.
That's right. So and I guess that did, I mean that probably means we'll never do the Snow Devils.
Oh boy,
that was a bad one. I'm gonna warn you, folks. That's the bad one in the bunch. It's pretty rough.
I've heard
pretty
people
rough.
Say that before too. I've heard you're not the only person I've heard say it.
Yeah.
I've never seen it. But yeah, so Wild Wild Planet, we give it a good thumbs up and we ask people, hey, if you love this kind of stuff, check it out. You probably will not be disappointed.
That's right.
Figure out what we're going to do.
We always have a blast when you sit in. I tell you, it's always a lot of fun. It's nice to have someone to play off of here. And
I appreciate it.
Yeah, man. It's a blast.
Really
absolutely a blast.
Yeah, I'm trying to be able to get in here and do some more of them with you. I mean, I really, it gives me something to really look forward to. And,
they're fun.
We'll keep on trucking. just like we'll Robert Crumb said, keep on trucking.
We'll do it. Yeah. Hey, folks, I do want to ask of you folks just one favor, and I've been mentioning this on a couple of the podcasts. We've just started a new Patreon campaign. This is a fundraising campaign just to help with the network and all, and the 25 different podcasts that we have here on Project Entertainment Network. Check it out. We've got some incentives, some prizes, some gifts for those of you that can make a little commitment to us. And check out our Patreon page at ProjectEntertainmentNetwork.com. And, of course, you know, with the holidays coming up, you want to go to the Project Entertainment Network store. You might find some cool Monster Attack merchandise up there that might make a good gift for Christmas or whatever. But check it out. We've got some really neat stuff up there that right now is 30% off. So check it out. There's some good specials going on all the time up there through our suppliers at the Project Entertainment Network store. And, folks, we will see you next Monday at 5 p.m. on a new episode of Monster Attack. Have a great week.
Hey guys, this is Ryan,
Nick,
and Mike,
the hosts of Your New Opinion. We're a bi-weekly comedy debate podcast.
Just a group of idiot friends who are very opinionated.
Each episode, we debate some hot-button issue and use every trick we can to get our judge to side with us.
You know, hot-button issues like books versus movies, is the Earth flat, and Godzilla versus King Kong.
We cover topics like pop culture, conspiracy theories, and everyday absurdity.
So find us on iTunes or wherever you download podcasts every other Friday. Again, that's Your New Opinion, only on the Project Entertainment Network.
This has been an exclusive presentation of the Project Entertainment Network.